Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Exchanges, a Cambridge University Press podcast, a joint production of Cambridge University Press and the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, and today I'm speaking with Lawson R. Wilson, MD, author of the book Toxic Stress: How Stress is Making Us Ill and What We Can Do About It. Lawson, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for agreeing to be on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Well, I'm a psychiatrist who's spent most of his career working in primary care settings. I'm an academic psychiatrist, and in that sense, I've been teaching people to integrate psychiatry and family medicine specifically during their training and their careers. So I've been fascinated by mind-body questions. My research is focused on depression and heart disease, and more recently, stress and chronic illness.
I was thinking that your book is very much, you know, squarely within that specialism that you just described. What led you to write a book about not just stress, but specifically toxic stress?
Well, the fascinating paradox that I've worked with in most of my career is that in the psychiatry side of my life, in the psychiatry culture, it's a foregone conclusion that stress is a powerful driver of most psychiatric illnesses. In the primary care culture, though we talk about stress, it's rarely measured and rarely a focus of treatment. And so what I've been puzzling with for many years, and specifically over the last 6 years while working on this book, is how can we get toxic stress into clinical practice? You know, toxic stress is a fascinating medical and social mystery because, you know, like pollution and global warming, it's all around us and yet too often invisible. Toxic stress is hard to measure and we prefer to ignore it until we have to face it. So this book aims to translate the best stress neuroscience into plain language and engaging stories to help us communicate better so we can more effectively manage stress-related conditions. And my best hope for this book is that it really guides the concept of toxic stress into clinical practice.
I mean, for me, as a novice to the subject, it was really interesting to read about toxic stress and also to what you just described, the appreciation that it's a subject that doesn't seem to get the study that it deserves, because I can't think of anybody I know who isn't aware of how stress can be debilitating. Although I don't think people can quite appreciate the extent of what you describe in your book, it's such a fascinating subject. Perhaps you could start us off by explaining, what is it, you know, that makes toxic stress toxic? What distinguishes the idea of toxic stress from other types of stress that you reference in your text?
Yeah. So part of what's confusing about stress is that good and tolerable stress is really good for us. You know, it keeps us fit. It's part of what tunes up our stress response systems. But toxic stress, especially if it lasts months or years, that can really make us sick, accelerate aging, cut years off our lives. And even though most of us can manage good and tolerable stress pretty well, and most of us get through life without a lot of exposure to toxic stress, it seems like about one in five of us, or about 20% of us, have experienced toxic stress in some form that is likely to give us at least symptoms or illness. And so toxic stress is a level of demand that we perceive as beyond what we can cope with. You know, good and tolerable stress are demands that we have plenty of resources for. But toxic stress overwhelms us both psychologically, physiologically, and sometimes socially. And when it goes on for long periods of time, like many months and years, then that leads to symptoms and illness.
It's, you know, fascinating to hear that description, and to, because it sounds, if I may make a metaphor here, it sounds like, you know, toxic stress is stress with a bullhorn blaring at you. And yet what makes it so fascinating is that, as you describe in the book, toxic stress is oftentimes invisible.
Yeah.
And it's something that we don't necessarily recognize. I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate upon how we recognize toxic stress and Also, why it's so oftentimes so difficult to do so.
Well, let's begin by thinking about some of the common sources of toxic stress. And, you know, they're often as invisible as pollution or high crime neighborhoods or unbearable relationships, like a harassing boss or an abusive parent. And it can, when you're in the thick of those exposures, it can be very hard to recognize that this amounts to toxic stress. Sometimes it's, you know, being in a war zone, having multiple injuries or multiple illnesses, and it's quite obvious. But often it's a combination, a cumulative combination of demands that exceed our capacity to cope.
I was also struck by, when I was reading your book, how the another element of that toxic stress is how it can linger long after the stressors themselves are gone, that they leave a legacy that we carry that continues to add to that. I was thinking in particular about how you described one of the case studies you referenced, Teresa, and her experiences, and how so much of a lot of what was causing her toxic stress was not in her present, but in her past. But it was something that you know, was still creating stress for her, even if she wasn't, you know, being exposed to it in the moment.
Exactly. And that gets to one of the definitions, I think, of toxic stress, which relates to the one of the fascinating facts about our stress response system is that it, by definition, is self-regulating. And good stress, even tolerable stress, is a challenge to the system that helps it regulate itself. Just the way exercise is good for our health, you know, a challenge like climbing stairs, it puts some exertion on our cardiovascular and respiratory systems. And then when we relax, the system goes back to its set point. And what's fascinating about it is that evolution has arrived at multiple different set points for our cardiovascular system, our immune system, our respiratory system, our energy metabolism system. And when we get stressed out so much that we can't re-regulate any component of this stress response system, then we have these cumulative dysregulations that build up and turn into symptoms and then disease. So it's this loss of the capacity to self-regulate that lays the groundwork for the emergence of these stress-related disorders.
It sounds very straightforward in that respect, but as you also write, it's something that's very, you know, challenging to study. Could you explain a bit how, you know, sort of the difficulties that we face in studying the stress response system and why it's important that we, you know, do so in order to be able to understand how it works?
Yes. So stress neuroscience, most people say, started around the 1950s with Hans Selye's book, The Stress of Life. And in that sense, you know, it's only 50 or 70 years old, which may sound like a long time to some people, but in the course of science, that still makes it a relatively young science. And one of the difficulties about studying the stress response system is that it is really a complex system of systems. You can think of it a little bit like an orchestra of multiple organ systems conducted by the central nervous system. And when it's working well, everything's in harmony and we don't even notice it. But stress neuroscience has had to work on sub-organ systems and very small pieces of this big complex system in order to try to identify components of it that respond to common stressors or even uncommon toxic stressors. And so part of what the book tries to do is help us understand how the evolution of stress neuroscience has been able to arrive at, for example, various ways of measuring stress and toxic stress. Because until you can measure it, most doctors aren't going to do much about it. And we have at least three kinds of measurements that have to figure into this assessment of the status of our stress response system, One is our own psychological perception. How stressed out am I? One is the cumulative burden of traumatic events in our whole lives. And the third is, how is our physiology responding? And that's a very complex question because it involves all these multiple organ systems. So you can see that it's that the process of measuring the stress response system is a complicated one. And that's one of the reasons that doctors haven't incorporated it into daily primary care practice.
I want to return to a phrase you used, which is how our stress response system is a system of systems. Because for me, when I was reading your book, that was one of the biggest revelations to just think of. I think of stress, you know, in terms of, you know, before I read this book, as being, you know, entirely mental, more psychological than physical, you know, although albeit causing a physical response. And what you describe is a far more intricate and synergistic process the complexity of which was really fascinating. So what exactly is this system of systems, and how exactly does it work?
Well, you can think of it as evolution's way of figuring out how to maximize survival. And so this system, even in utero, has to figure out what the optimal set points are and what's the optimal range of functioning, like your heart rate. It doesn't do very well below 30 or 40 beats per minute and doesn't do very well much above 160 or 180 beats per minute for very long. And so evolution has selected for organ systems that function pretty well across a range of values, but within a certain level of efficiency. And each component of the stress response system is intimately communicating with all the other components. And so the other important thing to understand is that there's a lot of redundancy in here. And so if I'm having difficulty with my gut and absorption, the rest of my body can kind of compensate for a while, and I can feed off my fat stores, and I can drink even though I can't eat very well. And the cardiovascular system can compensate for the immune system, and the immune system or the hormone system can compensate for lack of energy and within certain limits. And so that dance is crucial for what we think of as good health. And, you know, when we feel good, that's a sign that this stress response system is in pretty good tune. But when we feel sick, that's also an alarm system that some part of this stress response system is having trouble regulating itself and dealing with whatever the current demand is.
One of the things you do in the book that I thought was especially interesting was how you have a case study of a well-functioning stress response system, and your subject is the runner Usain Bolt. And I thought it was really fascinating to consider how, you know, what he's doing, you know, as an activity which, you know, looks physically demanding, is one that is also, as you describe, incredibly stressful and requires him to have a stress response system that is as efficient and as effective as his muscles.
Yes. He's, to my mind, one of the ultimate performers. And it was in the course of writing this book that I realized that people who perform at the extremes of our capacities are actually people who are extremely adept at tuning up their stress response systems. And so I create this fictional internal view about what's going on in his stress response system as he's getting ready for his final race in London, his final 100-meter sprint, and try to take the reader through the whole process of moving from a state of deep rest into a state of sort of maximum stress and output, all of it voluntary, of course, and then through the wind down period after the race is over. And it makes the point that coping with stress is very much a psychological, physiological, and social process. And in this particular situation, he doesn't win the race, but he does end up arriving at a resolution that's good for him and good for his competitors and the audience in general. And so I think it's useful to use that example as the epitome of what we can do with our stress response systems at optimal health. And it runs in contrast, it's a setup, really, to compare with the story that I tell about my patient, Teresa Langford, who has multiple stress-related conditions that nearly kill her before she kind of realizes what the challenge is and how to manage them.
I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate a bit upon what you just described in terms of how stress was killing Teresa, because it really is a, and she's not the only case study that you use to describe this, but you do talk about how stress has this abnormal physical as well as psychological effect. And it's something with which, you know, I think a lot of people might be familiar with to one extent or another. But what you describe is something far more extensive than many people appreciate. We might talk about how we, you know, we're stressed out, or we could talk about how, you know, it doesn't, you know, how it in the moment it does things, but you describe how it has short, medium, and long-term effects that sometimes we don't appreciate for decades.
Yes. You know, her story in terms of seeking healthcare doesn't begin until she's 34. And by the time she's 34, she's already got four chronic conditions, some of which she was unaware of. This is a woman who grew up in a very tough family, and she ended up being quite adept at managing the challenges of being a tomboy and of being in a broken family. And she ended up getting into the army and was extremely fit and outperformed a lot of her male platoon members. But she also encountered sexual abuse in the context of the army. She ended up injuring her knee in a training exercise that required her to eventually resign from the army. She had chronic pain in that knee. She had unrecognized ADHD that really interfered with her ability to get the kind of employment and keep the kind of employment she was looking for. And so by the time she was 34, she had a significant collection of risks called metabolic syndrome. And a lot of this was unrecognized by the primary care clinician that was taking care of her until she really, about 10 years later, developed hemorrhagic pancreatitis and spent 2 months in an intensive care unit and nearly died. And it was after that that she really ended up looking for the kind of help that would give her a kind of comprehensive picture of the cumulative stressors that had been sneaking up on her most of her life.
One of the things I really enjoyed most from your case studies that you reference is how they demonstrate how we are often aware of these, but we don't have treatments so much as we have coping mechanisms. And I'm thinking also, for example, of Mrs. B, who is another case you reference, where she has a coping mechanism that allows her to live with stress, but it was basically, you know, the coping mechanism might get you through the moment or might help you in the short term, but it doesn't deal with the long-term symptoms, which are ultimately, as you detail in these case studies, very corrosive.
Yeah. You know, none of us gets a crash course in how to cope with toxic stress. We learn it with the back of our hands, you know, in the tough way. And one of the points of this book is to sort of challenge us all to get smarter about understanding our stress profiles. You know, there is currently no standard method for finding out what our stress profiles are. And by that, I mean our strengths and then our vulnerabilities. Most of us don't know that we have a vulnerability, say, to diabetes or to high blood pressure when we get stressed out until we actually get diagnosed with the illness. But it is possible to learn some of these things that are often inborn as well as acquired that would help us be smarter about how we cope with demanding situations and how we recognize when we're in a toxic stress situation.
I was wondering if you could elaborate upon exactly what you mean by a stress profile. What is, how do we go about creating one, and how does that give us some opportunities to address our stress more effectively than just basically saying there are stressors I should avoid?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that the American Consortium of Cancer Networks decided on about 20 years ago was that at every visit, it would ask every patient to complete a distress thermometer, which is simply a 0 to 10 scale. How distressed are you? And then there's a little checklist about the things that might be distressing you, like finances or transportation or childcare. And just that simple question asked repeatedly is one way of raising into awareness the question about level of severity of stress. That's the kind of subjective awareness that I think we need to begin with. A second level is doing some kind of formal assessment of the cumulative adverse events that we've been exposed to. You know, one of the simplest measures that has a lot of predictive value is the Adverse Childhood Experiences Survey. It's just a 10-question item, single page, and you score on a 0 to 10 scale. But any score above 4 there is a very strong predictor for multiple poor health outcomes, even 10, 20 years later. And these are questionnaires given to people in their 20s or 30s or 50s about their childhood. And then the other component of this stress profile should be some fairly specific physiologic measures. Now, these are a little trickier to come up with and interpret, because each of us has a very different stress profile, and it's not efficient for all of us to have 100 different physiologic measures. But if I have asthma, for example, understanding how my immune system and my respiratory system respond to challenges could be very helpful for improving the way I navigate work and allergy season and infections. Without that, I'm pretty much flying blind, and so is my doctor. So what I'm hoping is that this book can challenge the healthcare system to get smarter about developing services that create these stress profiles. And let me give you an analogy. 50 years ago, we did not have anything that resembled a neuropsychological profile. But about 30 years ago, the psychology culture developed a battery of standard tests for assessing how somebody's mind and brain are functioning. And so now, people with Parkinson's disease or early dementia or have a traumatic head injury routinely get neuropsychological testing to assess the strengths and weaknesses of their current cognitive functioning. Something like that is what we need for understanding our stress profiles and our vulnerabilities to various stress-related conditions.
You also address ways in which we might be able to treat this as well. And I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate a bit upon what you describe as training our system, because it's in the same way that your book is a call to the health profession to, you know, work on giving us, you know, tools for measuring and determining our overall stress, you know, in stressors and how we deal with them. You also have a call for us to find ways to train ourselves, not just mentally, but physically, to better address toxic stress.
Yes. So one of the fundamental but often forgotten essential pillars of good treatment for chronic conditions is what's called self-management, daily self-management regimens. And this has to do with what each of us can do on a daily basis to improve our health with respect to a particular condition like depression or diabetes or asthma or heart disease. And this collection of behaviors, it can be meditation, exercise, social contacts, practicing pleasurable activities, deep breathing, diet sometimes, and sometimes it's working through coping workbooks like cognitive therapy techniques and that sort of thing. That self-management regimen is a version of what the most effective treatment programs have been for reducing the impact of toxic stress on chronic illnesses. For example, the Ornish Undo It program is a very effective program for either reducing or reversing the course of coronary artery disease. And it combines a fairly intensive stress management with diet and gentle exercise and social support in the form of a small group that meets once a week for 3 or 4 hours over the course of 6 to 9 months. And in the context of a program like that, people with a chronic condition or high risks for a chronic condition can retrain their stress response systems in ways that lower the burden of illness, increase a person's sense of agency or control, and dramatically reduce their dependence on medications or surgical procedures. That's a form of lifestyle medicine that has just emerged in the last 10 years or so. And I think it's something that anybody who's exposed to toxic stress would do well to understand, explore, and even practice, because it can be so powerful for relieving distress and reversing the course of some of these chronic conditions.
We appreciate the time you've taken to speak with us, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yes. My next book is actually a book of fiction stories based on interviews I'm doing with people who've had formative secrets. It's called The Lives of Secrets. And I'm interested in telling these stories from people that I interview about how a particular secret might have shaped their lives in some important way. Some people have an unrecognized illness. Some people had some kind of secret trauma in the family that they have to dance around. One person was in the witness protection program and had to create a whole new story and name for the whole family. So that's an interesting way of turning real stories into short fiction that can show the psychology of secrets at work.
Sounds like a very original approach. I look forward to seeing it when it comes out.
Well, thank you. It'll be another couple of years, but it's a fun project.
Well, Lawson, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Mark. It's been a pleasure.